Good evening. Can you hear me? Is this on? Okay. It gives me great pleasure to welcome library members and guests to this evening's lecture on Edith Kermit Roosevelt, the wife of Theodore Roosevelt, the 26th President of the United States. Good. Thank you. We are fortunate to have tonight's speaker, Sylvia Jukes Morris, whose biography, Edith Kermit Roosevelt, Portrait of a First Lady, has brought her nationwide acclaim. Edith Kermit Roosevelt, whose literary standards were very high, as we know from our current exhibition, could not have picked a more brilliant biographer than Sylvia Morris. Born and educated in England, Sylvia published Edith Kermit Roosevelt in 1980. The Christian Science Monitor said it represented craftsmanship of the highest order. Edith Kermit Roosevelt was reissued by Modern Library in the fall of 2001. And if you don't already have a copy, I'm sure you're going to want to buy one after the lecture. Just a few weeks ago, Mrs. Morris spoke briefly at the exhibition launch of The President's Wife and the Librarian in the Peluso Family Gallery exhibition space. We now look forward to hearing her speak at greater length about Edith Roosevelt, who was born in 1861 during the Civil War and died in 1948 during the Truman era. Morris's portrait reveals a most fascinating and reserved woman, now judged one of the most remarkable of the nation's first ladies. Mrs. Morris has published articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post. She has served as a judge for the National Book Awards and lectured at the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian Institution, and many other societies and libraries and colleges. She has appeared on television and at a symposium presented by the Paris Review and the English-speaking Union. Sylvia Morris is now writing the second volume of her extremely popular biography of Clare Booth Luce. We are delighted she has agreed to speak tonight about Edith Roosevelt. And now let us welcome Sylvia Morris.
Well, thank you, Jeanette, for that ecstatic praise. I want to say first, before I actually begin the lecture, just a few words. Some months ago, I got a call from Harriet Shapiro, who is the woman who has arranged this fantastic exhibition on Edith. She's head of the exhibitions at the Society Library. And she told me that she was preparing an exhibit made largely of letters from Edith Roosevelt to the Society's former librarian, Marion King. And she would like me to write an essay for the show's catalogue and perhaps also give a talk about the former First Lady. I agreed, not realizing that the subject of an earlier biography I had written would compete for space in my head with the subject of my current project, A Two-Volume Life of Clare Booth Luce. 6 months later, the battle for supremacy goes on, largely, I suspect, because of the empathy I feel towards the shy and private Mrs. Roosevelt, compared to the more extrovert, ambitious playwright, journalist, congresswoman, ambassador, painter, mosaicist, and scuba diver of more modern times. Anyway, Harriet, I forgive you, because you have created a spectacular show that makes Edith Roosevelt seem every bit as interesting as I continue to find her. Shortly after the death of Theodore Roosevelt in 1919, a historian wrote a letter of condolence to his widow, Edith. He would have been less but for you. And we old friends always knew this, and we were silently grateful to you. Although contemporaries recognized Edith Roosevelt's importance to the 26th president, subsequent generations have tended to overlook her. In fact, until Harriet Shapiro mounted the exhibition here and the letters in this library, she had hardly been recognized at all by institutional organizations. She also had thwarted would-be biographers by being that strange anomaly, a public figure who remained private in the glare of the spotlights. Throughout her public life, she granted no interviews, disliked being photographed, and protected her children from the overly curious. One hates to feel that all one's life is public property, she said. Nor was she a political activist in the manner of her much more famous niece, Eleanor Roosevelt. Only after her death, when her diaries and letters surfaced, was it possible to give her the place she deserves in the gallery of presidential wives. Yet hers is first and foremost a love story, for from early infancy she adored Theodore Roosevelt. Much as she cared for her children, and shattered as she was by two world wars, the relationship with him was paramount. It was in fact a passion for books that even at a young age cemented their friendship. One image of Edith stays with me always. It is of her sitting in a white dress at the age of 4 or 5 on the steps of the Roosevelt family's house on East 20th Street, the brownstone, just off Broadway, reading a book to 7 or 8 year old T.D., as he was known. She had recently joined T.D. and his brother Elliot and his sister Corinne as a pupil in the classroom on the brownstone second floor. Theodore's Aunt Anna was the teacher. She was a die-hard Southerner who read them Brer Rabbit stories and lots of poetry, so much so that Edith remembered reams of Tennyson, Longfellow, and Browning well into her old age. Edith was just 40 years old when the assassination of William McKinley had catapulted T.R. into the position of chief executive. Although she had already spent 12 years in public life, especially during T.R.'s 2 years as governor of New York, life in the White House, she visibly blossomed. The president relied on her wisdom, particularly in the choice of political appointments. And he said that whenever he went against her advice, he made a mistake. We all knew, their daughter Ethel once said, that the person who had the long head in politics was mother. The columnist Mark Sullivan wrote that she was, in the opinion of many, greater among women than her husband among men. Edith Kermode Carew was born on August the 6th, 1861, in Norwich, or should I say Norwich, Connecticut. Her maternal grandfather, General Daniel Tyler, in whose house she spent her early years, was an expert in artillery and the smelting of iron, and he served in the Army of the Mississippi during the Civil War. Edith inherited his stately carriage and demeanor and his sapphire blue eyes, as well as a small annuity, which would keep her financially independent for the rest of her life. Her paternal grandfather, Isaac Carew, he was actually of Huguenot descent, so it was Carew in French, the family name, anglicized, and also was an early shareholder of this library. He was a merchant prince whose fleet of ships transported such cargo as ivory combs, violin strings, sugar and blackstrap molasses between England, New York, and the West Indies. He bequeathed Edith his impressive library, along with a cellar of fine Madeira wines. His granddaughter would bring these out only on special occasions. Edith's mother, Gertrude, was a plain woman educated in the finest schools of New York and Paris. Although her singing voice was of operatic quality, she never performed professionally. And after the births of Edith and her other daughter, Emily, she became increasingly melancholic and hypochondriac. Freud would know why, wouldn't he? And the excessive gambling and drinking habits of her husband, Charles, exacerbated these traits. Under Charles Carew's mismanagement, the shipping line collapsed. And by the time Edith was 6 years old, the family no longer owned a house of their own. In summer, they stayed with the Tylers in Red Bank, New Jersey, and in winter with an aunt in Lower Manhattan. Charming and erudite when sober, Charles taught Edith Latin, horseback riding, and how to identify birds and plants. He also encouraged her love of theater, so that after his early death, when she was only 21, she had only fond memories of him. During Edith's months in New York, she continued to attend the Roosevelt's nursery school in the brownstone on East 20th Street. And since she was always neatly dressed and meticulous in her habits, the other children used to call her Spotless Edie. A shared love of books and nature drew her so close to Teddy that the Roosevelt's oldest child that he missed her badly during a long trip to Europe. Her face, he wrote in his diary when shown a picture of her, stirred up in me homesickness and longings for the past. As adolescent approached, the two old friends enrolled in Mr. Dodsworth's famous school for dancing and deportment on 26th Street and 5th Avenue. Here they learned to waltz and polka and how to conduct themselves in society. Edith was in demand as a partner, but Theodore usually won out. On her dance program, his name appears more often than any other. For regular schooling, starting at the age of 10, Edith attended Miss Comstock's, an exclusive private academy on West 40th Street, right near where the New York Public Library now stands. It's hard to imagine New York school children of today, even in private establishments, tackling the number of subjects that Miss Comstock's pupils studied routinely. In addition to the basics, they were taught zoology, botany, physiology, etymology, philosophy, music, Latin, Greek, German, and French. Edith struggled with German, but became fluent in the language of her ancestors, and throughout her life, she would pepper her correspondence with Gaelic phrases. But her best subject was English. She wrote poetry and learned lots of it by heart, especially Shakespeare. She once said that if his comedy, As You Like It, was ever lost, she would be able to write it out word for word. Macbeth was her favorite tragedy, a good study for her subsequent life in the Washington corridors of power. Romeo and Juliet, she said, was the greatest love story ever written, and her own was not far behind. A copy of Shakespeare's complete plays, a gift from Theodore, accompanied her everywhere, and she was once seen sitting on a pile of luggage, reading King John while waiting for her carriage. T.R. claimed she was the best-read person that he knew. He said she is not only cultured, but scholarly. This from a man who himself wrote 40 books, countless essays, and has 150,000 published letters. In the summer of 1878, 2 years after Theodore went to Harvard, he and Edith had a mysterious quarrel. The break came, according to Theodore, because both of them had tempers that were far from being the best, he said. Soon afterwards, Theodore fell in love with a tall, fair Bostonian named Alice Hathaway Lee. "You see that girl there?" he said to a friend. "She won't have me, but I will have her." And after graduating, he did. At the wedding, Edith Carreau, according to an onlooker, danced the soles off her shoes. But I've always thought it was more likely in frustration than happiness. At the same time, as one of her granddaughters told me, she never doubted that someday, somehow, she would marry Theodore Roosevelt. Before the newlyweds could move into Lee Home, their hilltop house at Oyster Bay, Alice died of Bright's disease, having given birth to a daughter named after her. Devastated by her death and that of his mother of typhoid fever in the same house on the same day, Theodore went west to be a rancher. In his absence, builders completed the Long Island house with its spectacular views of the Sound. And on his return, Theodore changed its name to Sagamore Hill, after an Indian chief who once lived nearby. If Edith wondered what a widower with only one child wanted with a 21-room country mansion, she had scant opportunity to ask, because Theodore had told his sisters, Bammy and Corinne, that during visits to the East, he preferred not to see Miss Carreau. He did not believe in second marriages, and perhaps feared the reawakening of romantic feelings. But one day, in the fall of 1885, either by chance or design, the old friends bumped into each other as Edith left Bammy's house after tea. She was now a poised, fresh-complexioned 24-year-old with chestnut hair and a gentle smile. Long suppressed emotions surfaced, and soon after this encounter they began meeting, clandestinely at first, in the Carrows parlour on East 36th Street. By the time they appeared together at Sagamore Hill Hunt Ball, they had secretly agreed to marry. Edith, meanwhile, would go ahead with plans to live abroad with her sister and mother, where the dollar went a good deal further in those days than it does now, and Theodore returned temporarily to North Dakota. To everyone's surprise, the New York Times announced the pending nuptials. Theodore suspected a servant who had seen frequent envelopes addressed to Edith of leaking the news. In a letter of apology to Bammy, Theodore rebuked himself for his inconstancy. It was a state of mind that's hard for us to imagine in our own time. "Were I sure there were a heaven," he wrote, "my one prayer would be that I would never go there, lest I should meet those I loved on earth who are dead." Nevertheless, he told his sister, it was true, that later in the year he intended to marry. Edith wrote frequently from London, and one of her few letters to survive, I say few because she burned all the letters from Theodore at the end of her life and also destroyed the one she found that she had written to him. So only a few that her daughter managed to rescue from the flames have survived, unfortunately. She wrote, "I know you know I love you very much and would do anything in the world to please you. You know all about me, darling. I never could have loved anyone else. I love you with all the passion of a girl who has never loved before." And then she added, "And Mama says, I must tell you that I am very practical and know a great deal about money." This was a timely boast, for Theodore was about to lose half his cattle, a quarter of his patrimony, in a catastrophic Badlands winter. It would be left to Edith to make order of his ravaged finances. The wedding of Theodore Roosevelt to Edith Carew took place on December the 2nd, 1886, in St. George's, Hanover Square, in London, during a pea soup fog. On the way to the church, Theodore's best man was appalled that his groom didn't have any gloves. So suddenly he stopped the carriage, darted out, and rushed into a store to buy him a pair of gloves. As Edith walked up the misty nave, all she could see, iridescent in the gloom, was Theodore's bright orange haberdashery. During a three-month honeymoon in Europe, Edith became pregnant. I found in the library, actually it was in a box underneath her a table at Sagamore Hill, I found some personal things, her passports, some letters from President Taft and Henry Adams and all sorts of stuff. And amongst them was this receipt. And I found that it was the hotel that they'd stayed at on the Riviera, the Italian Riviera, during their honeymoon. And it said what they ordered for room service. They ordered two omelets and a bottle of Chablis and a cord of wood, firewood. And I worked out the date on the receipt. And it was the exactly 9 months later that their first child was born. So don't throw out the laundry lists, that's what I say. During a three-month honeymoon in Europe, Edith became pregnant, and with this pending addition to the family, the question then arose of what was to become of baby Alice. Theodore had cavalierly given her away to his unmarried Bammy sister to take care of, and he assumed this arrangement would continue. But Edith insisted on raising the child as her own. In the first 2 years of their marriage, Theodore supplemented his income by writing articles, as well as a substantial history called The Winning of the West. Being appointed Civil Service Commissioner in 1889 gave him regular salary, and for the winter months, he moved his family to a rented house in Washington, D.C. Edith suddenly enjoyed the sophisticated social life of the capital and soon became a member of the cultivated group which assembled at the Lafayette Square house of Henry Adams. But motherhood rapidly became her chief preoccupation, because between 1887 and 1897 she gave birth to five children. Ted came first, followed by Kermit in 1889, Ethel in 91, Archie in 94, and then Quentin, who would turn out to have his father's charm and intellect and his mother's practicality. In the White House, she'd have a final pregnancy, but miscarried. When Theodore became governor of New York in 1899, his money worries ceased. With a salary of $10,000 a year, comparable to about $200,000 today, and a large architectural folly of a house with 18 bedrooms, which was heated at state expense by 350 tons of coal a year, Edith settled in happily with her six bunnies, as she called them. She left Albany with reluctance when Theodore was tapped for the vice presidency in 1901, and still thought fondly of those 2 years there, even after the assassination of McKinley elevated her to the White House. On a teenage visit to the executive mansion, Edith had been impressed by the splendid halls once roamed by Lincoln. But now, as its mistress, she found them gloomy, with their dark frescoed ceilings and heavy Victorian furniture. She could even imagine the old emancipator himself walking those halls. More critical than the decor were the impossibly cramped second-floor living quarters and the inconvenience of having the president's office right next to the sitting room, the family sitting room. Edith said it was worse than living over the store. Clearly drastic changes were necessary, and she called in the New York architectural firm of McKim, Mead & White to draw up plans. Theodore prevailed on Congress to approve them, and in the summer of 1902, with a budget of over $500,000, the work to restore the mansion as near as possible to its original classical design began. The Roosevelts moved it to Sagamore Hill for the summer, as they did in those days in any case. Congress went into recess in March, didn't come back till October. Would that they would do now, because, you know, we get all the government we don't deserve. This classical design meant many, many changes. Out went the fine Tiffany screen from the north vestibule, never to be found again. It would probably, if sold today, have paid for the entire restoration. And down came a large conservatory. Where the latter once stood, the architects were able to follow a plan of Thomas Jefferson and construct a colonnade, as he had planned, to link a new west wing of executive offices to the house proper. In the basement, in place of ducts and pipes, they carved out a series of elegant reception rooms, and Edith converted the corridor, linking them, into a gallery of portraits of first ladies. Incidentally, the only really heavy, ornate Victorian pieces that survived the purge were Lincoln's bedroom suite. Both Theodore and Edith thought it too historic to get rid of. Edith kept in close touch with Charles McKim throughout the renovation. "I do not like my writing desk at all," she wrote in response to one blueprint. "I think it ought to be made to match the furniture," which was rosewood, incidentally. In October, as the work neared completion, Edith ordered an inventory of all of the mansion's possessions so that future presidents could not dispose of them as Chester Arthur had done. He'd sent off 24 wagon loads of stuff. And he said, our successors must not be allowed to do this, and they have not been since. And it was at this point that the old executive mansion was rechristened, given its new name by Theodore Roosevelt, and called forevermore the White House. One item hitherto missing that Edith wanted to get back was a lusty oil painting by George Watts entitled Love and Life. Her prudish predecessors had banished the lusty oil to the Corcoran Gallery. She retrieved it and hung it directly opposite her own desk in the upstairs gallery at the heart of the living quarters. From here, having dispensed with the office of housekeeper, she supervised all activities, public and private, of the establishment. The White House had not seen such an accomplished hostess since the days of Dolly Madison. To help her, she appointed a young native Washingtonian to be the first social secretary. To complement the cultivated Americans that graced her dinner table, such as Henry James, Augustus St. Gordon's, Owen Wister, and John Lafarge, she ordered a complete set of Wedgwood china decorated with the Great Seal of the United States. This acquisition inspired her to collect at least one piece representing each previous administration. These acquisitions grew. She gradually got them back and became the nucleus of the present Smithsonian White House China collection. Friday evening music halls were a feature of the winter season under Edith's supervision. Several hundred guests assembled in the East Room to hear such stars as the opera diva Nellie Melba, the pianists Paderewski and Ferruccio Busoni, and the Vienna Male Voice Choir. The young Pablo Casals performed in the Roosevelt White House 58 years before he returned to play for the John Fitzgerald Kennedys. Theodore was usually thoroughly bored at these concerts. His idea of good music was a rousing march by John Philip Sousa. And his choice of a suitable gift for the classical musicians was a signed copy of his book on the liberation of Cuba, The Rough Riders. Edith's day in the White House began with a family breakfast at 8:30. By 9, after a walk in the garden with Theodore, she was at her desk, clipping newspapers, articles, answering letters, planning menus and guest lists, and scrutinizing the appointment schedule. Between 11 and 12, on Tuesdays, she had lively discussions with cabinet members' wives. Theodore invariably brought guests to lunch at 1:30, and after that Edith received callers, or went snooping, as she called it, in search of antiques, for which she had an infallible nose. Snoopers are born, not made, she once told her son Kermit, who shared her ability to spot a valuable bargain in an unlikely place. At 4 o'clock, on most afternoons, Edith mounted her favorite horse, Jadzenka, named after the heroine of a Polish novel that she had read, and she accompanied Theodore on his daily ride through Rock Creek Park. On these outings, she looked so young that people mistook her for the president's daughter. In Ethel's judgment, she was not a first-rate horsewoman because she did not hunt, but she had good hands and handled her mount expertly. When she got back, she read to the children and afterwards joined Theodore and yet more guests for dinner. Theodore Roosevelt enjoyed the role of chief executive as well as any president, but as the years in office took their toll, Edith noticed lines appearing on his face and a paunch above his waistline. She did a little more than raise an eyebrow when he ate 12 eggs for breakfast and poured cream until it ran over the side of the plate at lunch. She believed that a man with a huge brain needed plenty of nourishment. Neither she nor anyone else, except perhaps the White House doctor, knew that since the age of 40, Theodore Roosevelt had been suffering from arteriosclerosis. He was blind also in one eye from a boxing match that he'd fought in the White House. Early into Tejar's second term, Edith paid $195 for a small hunting lodge on 5 acres of land in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. It was 125 miles from the capital. She named it Pine Knot, and it would serve as a kind of Camp David, where Tejar could go to escape the cares of state. This little cabin has now been preserved by the generosity of a member of this library, Theodore Roosevelt IV and his wife. They bought it and they gave it to the nation, and it's now open for tourists and visitors to see. The lodge consisted of only one room on the ground floor and 2 bedrooms upstairs. There was a piazza with a hammock for reading and woods for walking. Edith bought supplies of pork, ham and codfish at the local store, and Theodore supplemented these by shooting deer, partridge and quail. He also prepared their 2 meals a day, usually steak and eggs for breakfast, and quite often chicken, cornbread and wild strawberries for dinner. Edith did the washing up with water from a well. There was no electricity. After weekends here, Edith saw the lines fade and the color return to her husband's cheeks. But it was in the isolation of Pine Knot that she especially feared for his safety and brought in a couple of armed men to police the woods just in case of predators. In effect, this guard was the first Secret Service detachment in our history. And it was not until 1907 that Theodore made it official and it became a permanent part of White House life. At the end of her 7.5 years in the White House, Edith received nothing but praise. The Secretary of the Institute of Architecture said that she'd made the White House charming, a charming and refined mansion. The wife of a senator who was hostile to T.R. described her as the loveliest and wisest of hostesses. To Henry Adams, she was the best read of companions, and he couldn't bear to see her go. T.R.'s military aide wondered when the White House would again have such a mistress. She was, he said, like a luminiferous ether, pervading everything and everybody. And she had never in those 7.5 years made a single mistake. Edith returned happily to Sagamore Hill, but the decade following was far from tranquil. World War I brought horrors beyond imagining for the Roosevelts. In Europe, the youngest but one son, Archie, was seriously wounded. One of his kneecaps was totally shattered, and his arm was so badly broken that the main and nerve was severed. Ted also was wounded in the leg. And then in the waning days of the conflict in July 1918, the youngest, Quentin, was shot down in a dogfight over German lines and killed. Intellectually, he was the brightest of the children and the one most like T.R. in warmth and in the warmth of his personality. Both parents were heartbroken, but showed no bitterness. "You can't bring up boys as eagles," said Edith, "and expect them to turn out sparrows." But as Theodore wrote Kermit, "Mother will carry the wound green to her grave." He never recovered from Quentin's death himself, and after a series of illnesses, he died 6 months later of a pulmonary embolism at 60, just as an 18-year-old at Harvard he had told the doctor he would. His valet woke Edith to give her the news. In her diary for that day, she wrote only, "Theodore died at 4 a.m., had had sweet, sound sleep." Live for the living was Edith's motto, and she spent her remaining 29 years obeying it. She entertained children and grandchildren and traveled all over the world. "I have salt water around my heart," she often said. Ships were her favorite form of transport, and each winter she would sail off for the Caribbean or Latin America or Greece. With Kermit, she took the Trans-Siberia Railroad across Russia and was in Japan just after the great earthquake of 1923. And staying, of course, in the great Frank Lloyd Wright Hotel, which survived, the only building that survived the quake, and has recently, just a couple of years ago, pulled down. Go figure. In the early 1920s, Edith began the correspondence with the New York Society Librarian's librarian, Marion King, that is the main subject of the library's current exhibition. It would continue for over 25 years and eventually run to almost 600 letters. In 1980, Mrs. King's daughter gave the correspondence to Harvard, and some of it is now on display here. It's hard to imagine in this age of television, the internet and the cell phone, that anyone could read as much as Edith Roosevelt and carry on an epistolary relationship by mail that was almost entirely about books. But she did. On one occasion, I recall, she ordered 9 volumes in 1 week. At other times, she asked for weighty tomes such as Byron's Letters, Racine's Essays, Lives of Diderot and of Chopin, both in French, biographies of Lincoln, Voltaire, and Goya, the poetry of Gerard Manley Hopkins and Edna St. Vincent Millay. She enjoyed books on travel and exploration by Gertrude Bell and Freya Stark, the novels of Conrad, and especially those of Willa Cather, whom she called a great rock in a weary waste of twaddle. For what she called her nightcaps, she used to ask the librarian for a good supply of sexless mysteries, quite often the ones by Agatha Christie. On one voyage, she reread all of Shakespeare's comedies, and when the 3-volume set of all his plays wore out, they literally fell apart. She rather autocratically asked the librarian of this library to get them rebound for her by the library's bookbinder. Even after the correspondence blossomed and the friendship grew as the years went by, It took her 10 years before she started to address Miss King as Marion, but she herself never signed herself Edith. It was always Edith Kermit Corot, very formally, or simply EKR. In the late 1920s, she surprised everyone by buying a house in Brooklyn, Connecticut, once owned by her great-grandfather, Tyler. Why, her family wondered, did she want to spend summers in a hot valley when she could be on the breezy shores of Long Island? "I love to see my grandchildren," she joked, "but I prefer to see their backs." Perhaps, too, after some 60 years of Roosevelt's, she felt a need to explore her own roots. Resolutely private since the White House years, Edith nevertheless came out publicly in support of Herbert Hoover in the 1932 presidential election. She was annoyed and tired of being mistaken for Franklin Delano Roosevelt's mother, and even his wife on occasion, and she wanted to set the record straight. In tone strongly reminiscent of British royalty, I heard the broadcast, she spoke out for the Republican candidate in a Madison Square Garden broadcast. I didn't hear it at the time, of course. turned out to be an accomplished and manipulative orator. She once asked her granddaughter, "Shall I make them laugh or shall I make them cry?" Old age brought physical ailments and World War II emotional traumas almost beyond endurance. All three remaining sons enlisted. Archie was wounded in the same leg and the same arm as in World War I, and would spend the rest of his life suffering pain from his injuries. Theodore Jr., the most decorated American officer of the war, landed in Normandy on D-Day and soon after suffered a fatal heart attack. Kermit, in an alcoholic depression, shot himself while with the army in the Aleutian Islands. "You will know how the bottom has dropped out for me," he had once written his mother on the death of T.R., "for who has lost father has lost all." Edith must now have felt the same way about the son who was most like her in personality and tastes. One final horror disturbed Edith's last years. On August the 6th, 1945, her 84th birthday, the United States dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima. Nagasaki followed 3 days later. For one who had lived through a civil war and 17 administrations of 27 different presidents, seven of whom she had known personally, the nuclear holocaust was a gruesome finale. In spite of this and the deterioration of her heart, she continued to be interested in the world. She even planned her own funeral, asking for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony to be played and just a small bouquet from her children of posies on her coffin. And she said, "Please, no embalming." When the famous photojournalist Stefan Laurent came to interview her almost in the last year of her life, he especially wanted her to identify a photograph of Theodore Roosevelt as a small boy, standing on the second floor of his grandfather's Broadway house, watching Lincoln's funeral procession as it went up Broadway. She noticed, recognized it at once. She said, "Yes, and I was there too. And I started to cry at all the black hangings and the draped flags and the horses, the black horses." She said, "I got very upset and I cried. And those naughty boys, they locked me in a closet. So I saw no more of Lincoln's funeral." And anyway, they sat in front of the fire, and Laurent was absolutely enchanted by her conversation and spiritedness. At the end, he said, "You know, Mrs. Roosevelt, if I were 10 years older, I would propose to you." And quick as a whip, she came back and said, "If I were 10 years younger, I would accept." On September the 30th, 1948, Edith Kermit Roosevelt died peacefully in her sleep at the age of 87. She'd always loved poetry, and one of her favorite verses by Walter Savage Landor seems to sum up her life and character. "I strove with none, for none was worth my strife. Nature I loved, and next to nature, art. I warmed both hands before the fire of life. It sinks, and I am ready to depart." I'd be happy to take questions if anybody has any. Yes. Her brother-in-law. Oh, her cousin. It was Theodore's fifth cousin. Yes. Well, of course, she was always a staunch Republican. So, of course, and also she didn't like all the money, the rich people's money that he was giving away, you see. She lived on this annuity, and she didn't like the growing taxes and all of that. So she certainly wouldn't have approved of anything that Franklin Roosevelt did politically. And as for Eleanor, of course, Eleanor was always known in the family as the ugly duckling growing up, because she was the daughter of T.R.'s brother, who also, incidentally, was an alcoholic. So no wonder poor Kermit had this inheritance. He got it from Charles Carew, and it was also in the Roosevelt family. So he was just an alcoholic from very early on. And so that was the relationship. And she always got on very well with Eleanor. There was never any problem there. And she got along, yes, fine. But there were little incidents, you know, when they got married, Franklin and Eleanor. It took place here in New York at his mother's house. And, of course, they were going to have an adjoining house, and the mother-in-law, Sarah, was going to have the door that opened into their house and broke through. She broke through so she could keep an eye on everything. But apparently at the wedding, the poor bride and groom was standing in a corner, and there was nobody paying any attention to them. They were all around Theodore Roosevelt. And Alice, T.R.'s first daughter, said, oh, typical father. He always wants to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. Yes. Now, stories have grown up over the years that Edith was a wicked stepmother, and she didn't get along with Alice and all of that, and Alice rebelled, and Alice was a naughty girl. She used to take snakes to parties in her handbag and let them out and in the middle of the party and all of this, and go on the roof to have a smoke, and she was just rebelling because she really was rebelling because she wanted more attention from her father. But Edith had raised her, and Edith had even spent every night after night, stretching her legs, which were in iron, those iron things they used to put on children who had kind of rickets, I suppose. It was a lack of vitamin C or something. And so she just treated her exactly as she treated her own children. And the most telling thing for me, because I never found any evidence whatsoever in Edith's correspondence to Alice, it was a perfectly civil and friendly correspondence between the two. And when Alice married in the White House, the first thing she did after she made her vows, she turned from the makeshift altar that they'd put up in the East Room, and as she walked down the fictional aisle, the first person she turned to was her stepmother and threw her arms around her. And I thought that was the most telling thing about any kind of bad relationship. It didn't exist. Yes, and if you look at him, you know, he sort of resembles T.R. He was much older than Alice, and she was madly in love with him. But she actually caught him once in flagrante on somebody's, I think it was Sissy Patterson's, the newspaper editor, owner, on the bathroom floor. Alice actually encountered him doing this. And Alice herself was no saint after that. And as you know, Alice's only daughter was actually the child of another man. Senator, I think it was Senator Warren, yes, Senator Warren. So, is that it? Okay, well, thank you. Oh, by the way, I want to just say something before we go. The person who edited my book on Edith Roosevelt is here tonight. His name is Joseph Cannon. He's now left publishing and gone on, not in a way, he's stayed in publishing in a way, but he's on the other side now. He's a famous novelist. And his book called The Good German was made into a movie last year or two with George Clooney and Kate Blanchett and Tobey Maguire, directed by Steven Soderbergh. So you see, you can start one way in life and you can end up another. Thank you, Joseph, for everything.
Was it interesting? I hope.
So interesting.
Thank you very much. Thanks for everything. Okay, were you here? I missed you. You moved. So you moved back.
Yes, I had a coffee.
Because your turn. Was it all right?
It was perfect.
Well, I tried to make it about the literary thing.
Hi there. How are you? So glad to see you.
It was engaging.
Well, I loved it.
Did you?
Yes.
You learned anything?
Oh, I learned a lot.
I'm on the way out.
Oh, okay.
All right. We'll do dinner.
In May. We're not going to let another month go by. Okay.
All right.
T.R.'s biography.
T.R.? Yes. His autobiography or any biography?
Short. Short
biography. She started the modern press.